Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You're listening to Total EM. Today I have with me Fred Wu, and Fred's just, he kind of does everything. Well, let's make it easy. Fred, can you introduce yourself?
Hey, Chip. Thanks for having me on. Again, my name is Fred Wu. I'm a full-time practicing emergency medicine PA and have been for the past 13 years. And I am currently a PA residency program director at UCSF Fresno in Fresno, California.
Awesome. Now, Fred, you took out one of the most important parts. You're heavily involved in SEMPA. Talk about that real quick.
Yeah, so SEMPA, which is the Society of Emergency Medicine Physician Assistants, is really the national group that represents emergency medicine PAs, and we advocate and provide education and networking opportunities for PAs across the country. I am currently on the board of directors. I am serving my year as president-elect, and I've been on the board for a few years. I also chair the education committee, and I'm also a member of the postgraduate education committee.
And Fred makes that sound like it's no big deal, but it's a really time-consuming job. And Fred, for the last year, because I was at SEMPA 360, Fred was running around the whole time. I mean, you stayed busy. I mean, everyone on the board is going to stay busy. And even the people not on the board who helped SEMPA out, they stay busy. But Fred, I think we take it almost too lightly. Now, there's going to be another SEMPA 360 here. It's every year. That's the good news. So tell us about next year. Can you give us a little hint on what's going on there?
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, SEMPA 360 really is the emergency medicine PA conference to go to, the event of the year, where the vast majority of folks, you know, around 500 or so PAs come together for a state-of-the-art education by some of the best educators emergency medicine has to offer. And next year we'll be in San Antonio, Texas, so right in the middle of the country, and it's going to be May 3rd to the 7th, 2018. So definitely put that in your calendar.
This is not just for emergency medicine PAs, because I mean, we have more than just that who listen to the podcast. We have physicians. In fact, a couple of physicians we got to interview for some 360 promotional material for hopefully next year, which I guess I need to get all that stuff together there. Fred, I'll get that to you. It's in the mail. But all this great stuff that you work on, and I think we kind of almost take it lightly because there's so much that you do. This is for everyone. It's not just for the emergency medicine PAs. It's very well designed for EMPAs, but we've got other people, physicians, NPs I know I saw there, and then we had some others out there too. So this is definitely the thing to go to. Now, I don't make any money off of this. Fred, I don't think they actually even pay you either. So, I mean, I guess we're not making money off of this. It's just we're there to help out, and this is something that we really support.
If I got paid for doing this, I would have such a fantastic full-time job and I'd be so rich. But like you said, I don't. I guess we can get that out of the way for my disclaimers. I'm not being paid by anyone. I'm in academics, so it feels like I don't get paid at all pretty much. And yeah, 360, you know, with our CME, we've had folks attend from all various levels, from physicians to nurse practitioners. We get paramedics that come. Occasionally we get students. So it's a really a good mix. Now, obviously, the majority of them are emergency medicine PAs. But again, you know, we recognize the workforce is a team effort. All of those levels that I mentioned are all part of the teams. We are definitely happy to have anyone who's interested in improving their care attend our conference. And to point out, I know you're being very kind with all the kudos, but it's a lot of work done by the SEMPA Education Committee. They endure my many phone calls and emails. Unfortunately, I'm sure I'm spammed now to some of their email addresses. And the staff within SEMPA, you know, from the executive director to folks that do the conference planning with the logistics are phenomenal and make it an incredibly successful conference.
We're almost getting a little off course because we're talking about so much about SEMPA. Not that it's not a bad thing, because I enjoy us talking about SEMPA, and SEMPA is a great thing to go to if you haven't picked that up yet. Let's talk about something different here for a second. Let's talk about what we got you on here for. Now, we had you come on to talk about a few different things, and we'll see how far we get. We may have to break this up into a couple different podcasts. One thing, it's getting that time of year. We have new grads. I know we have students who are listening to this podcast because they've messaged me and stuff like that. And this isn't just going to be for students. But Fred, let's talk about trying to find the emergency medicine job that's right for you, because there are so many different parts. And one part we're going to talk about is contracts. But honestly, contracts, we may just have to have its own podcast because that's so tricky. But let's talk about for a second, how do you find that ideal job, the thing that's going to be right for you to start your career or further your career?
Yeah, that's a great point, Chip. I don't know about you, but you know, when I was in PA school, we didn't really have a lecture on this, on how to go find a specifically an emergency medicine job. Like I mentioned before, you know, I've been in practice about 13 years. I was in community for 12 years, mostly as a lead PA. So I had a chance to interview lots of folks and talk to folks who had big aspirations of becoming an emergency medicine PA. I tell a lot of folks that there are lots of ways to look. Hey, it's 2017. The internet is here. Google is, again, not paid by Google or anything like that, but Google is here. Just about anyone can look up jobs and try to find where they want to go. And I tell folks really that lots of places to look. I mean, you can look on the internet. There's, you know, if you just Google or go to the various job centers. So for example, SEMPA has a career center where there's emergency medicine posted jobs. AAPA has a career center. And then some of the regular employment sites such as Indeed or Monster, some places advertise through those websites. So the internet is a powerful tool these days looking for a job. And then you can also go to, for example, some hospitals directly employ the PAs. So you can go to the hospital websites to look for job postings that way. These days, many of the large contract management groups, so these are groups that are actually contracted with the hospital to staff the emergency department. And these groups, just to name a few, again, I'm not paid by anybody, but MCARE, Team Health, CEP, US Acute Care Solutions. And these folks also have huge web presence where you can go to their websites and basically look at a map to see what states they provide services in and also see what opportunities are available. So I think that's another way of doing it. And then journals. I mean, yes, again, 2017, some people still read journals. They do come print in the mail, believe it or not. Some journals advertise positions, and that's a great way to see what's out there also. And I think there's PA journals such as JAPA, but I also tell folks, you know what, you should look in the emergency medicine journals, because in Annals of Emergency Medicine or Academic Emergency Medicine, basically wherever they're advertising jobs, it's a great place to at least find a point of contact so you can reach out to that person who's advertising for a position and say, hey, you know what, I'm a PA. Do you guys use PAs in the ED? Are you looking for any? It's just another avenue to find possible open positions.
I have something that is a little different of a twist than what you mentioned, just to add to this, because you mentioned very first thing, online resources. Online resources are excellent. Do not get me wrong there. But sometimes you have to keep in mind, if you can see it, so does everyone else. So you may have a position where hundreds, maybe even thousands of people are applying. Now, sometimes it's not that big of an issue. Sometimes it's just a few people and it's not that much different than any other job. But I'm sure you kind of run into the situation. And I've had some fellow colleagues who, you know, new grad out of school, couldn't find a job because they only went online. Everyone else is also applying online. So it was really hard for them. But one thing I found that was extremely helpful that we didn't mention yet, actually looking at the specific places and calling them, making that cold call. Now, you kind of mentioned it with like finding the employment agencies or finding the hospitals, but I'll sometimes just, if I'm interested in a position, I've actually done this before, well, I'll just call or find who could be a contact person and get a hold of them, even if they don't have a position listed. It, basically, one of the ways I did that for one position was I did what you said, where I found the emergency physician hiring service and then asked them if they want any PAs or if they're interested in PAs. And that was how I found one position that was of interest to me. So there's all different ways to do this. Don't feel like you have to use the internet, and don't feel like you have to go to the library to read a journal to find that, because I don't know who actually keeps journals. Maybe just Fred, maybe a few others, but I read all mine electronically at this stage. That's no offense to you, Fred. I'm sure paper is good for the planet.
No, not at all. And just to actually add on to what you said, I actually gave this lecture to my residents today and told them the same exact thing you just said, which was great. If you don't know where you're going, or if you know where you're going to go location-wise, but have no idea who staffs the emergency department or a contact, I think doing a cold call is a great idea. And what I would just add to that is just call and ask for the medical director. And a lot of times these facilities, the medical director has an office or their own private line. You can talk to them or leave a voicemail and do what you just said. That, hey, you know what, I'm a PA looking for a PA job. Do you guys use PAs? And I think that's a great way to introduce yourself. And the next thing, too, is that some of the best jobs are really just word of mouth. You know, you hear about it from a classmate of a friend, of a classmate of a cousin, of a, you know, third generation, you know, uncle or something like that. But definitely use the contacts that you have, you know, whether it's contacts from PA school or other physicians or any number of those things can help you facilitate getting a job of where you want to go.
Let's build off of this. Let's say I have looked around, I found a couple positions that are interesting, and now I am trying to figure out which ones, because for me, the next step, usually what I do is I look and I say, okay, this position has this, this one doesn't, or I'm trying to help differentiate some of the key factors that are going to help me in my decision making. Now, some of that's going to be individualized, right? You may find that, well, it's got to be closer to home for me, or it needs to have this kind of salary range, or whatever's most important for you. You got to figure that out on your own. But what do you do to, what are some of the big things that may play a role that are probably a little more important than others as far as finding that right position for you?
And I really tell people that you need to look at the practice setting of where you want to end up and what you're ultimately looking for in your practice. Obviously, the location is key. So if you know you or a spouse has no interest in living in one part of the country, then don't go there. But obviously, if you want to go to California or Missouri or Florida, any of those places, figure out where you want to go. And then you want to look at the actual ED itself. Is it a community hospital? Is it an academic center? Is it a critical access hospital where there are very limited resources? Those are things to keep in mind. What kind of group staffs the ED? Is it a local group that's been there for a long time? Is it one of these large contract management groups that's been there for a long time too? And then obviously the big thing I tell folks is looking at what is your role in the ED and what is your scope of practice? You know, are you going to be a PA that sits in triage all day, helps to triage patients when they first come in for 10 hours a day? Are you going to be in the fast track, or are you going to be in the main ED, or will you have a combination of all those things? I think it's important to keep that in mind. And also, how do they utilize PAs? Do they utilize PAs to your full scope of practice? And then what's the volume of the site? Is it really, really busy? Is it moderate volume? Is it, you know, low volume? You know, how busy do you want to be? And then also scheduling is also key too with the groups, and that, you know, when you come in, are you pretty much the low man, low person on the totem pole where you're going to be stuck working nights, weekends, and holidays for the next 2 years until you get some seniority? Or is it scheduled equally amongst all the PAs so that everyone does their share of nights and weekends and holidays? I think those are all really key things to look for. And going back real quick to the community versus academic versus critical access hospital. So traditionally, places that are more remote, more rural, typically use PAs to their full scope, where they're performing procedures and, you know, working in the main ED and seeing sicker people. But keep in mind, though, too, is that when you work in the community, sometimes even in a more suburban, ruralish environment, you may not have all the resources available as a academic hospital may have. So if, just throwing it out there, for some reason, if you can't live without neurosurgery, ENT, plastics, whatever, going to go practice in the middle of nowhere may not be the right fit for you.
Fred, this is an important part of this. You just mentioned that at the end, so let's go into this a little bit more, because talking about that community versus rural and suburban and critical access and all that stuff, that's an important part of deciding how you want to do, because some of these, you may get more training than others. Obviously, your residency man, you know, you talk about having a residency, and that's hard to do it if you're someone like me who practices in a rural setting, has always practiced in a rural setting. I didn't get to do the residency training. I have a different type of background that helped suit me there and, you know, did the CAQ, but it's still different than what your students are going through and what your residents are going through. So at the same time, you have to double check and make sure that there is going to be sufficient training for your site. Now, if you're an experienced PA listening to this, you've been doing this for 20 some odd years, you probably just need to know how to do the system and what the rules are for your site. And that's about it. That may be all you need for training. But the new grad PA, I know we're looking at hiring new grad PAs at my main shop. It's not a bad thing, but we have to figure out how we're going to safely balance their education and their time so that they're getting stuff. But we're also working for a different type of agency, which we'll talk about this here in a second. But, you know, my group is an independent contractor group, and independent contracting groups notoriously pay really well, but they have little support as far as training and education opportunities and stuff like that. Now, given there are some that are more reliable than others and things like that, but that's something to have to keep in mind is this going to be a job where you're going to have sufficient time and training? Is that time going to be protected? Is there going to be time for you to just do your charting, or is that going to be stuff you have to do during your shift? All those types of things, you kind of have to factor in there. You have to factor in early.
Yeah, so that's a great point that you definitely want to bring up, like when you interview, and that can, I'm sure, be a whole other section we talk about too, is what's what you're talking about essentially is, what's the onboarding process? So when I come on here as a new grad or someone with experience, how do you bring me on to facilitate my growth into the system? So obviously it's going to be different if you're a brand new graduate versus someone who's been out for 20 years. But those new grads, let's just talk about them right now, you know, they really need a lot of mentorship and training and onboarding to where they're able to work efficiently and safely. Places that take on PAs, take on new grads, need to have some sort of plan in progress where they can support their PAs. And as a PA coming on, you definitely want to be in a supportive environment. You don't want to interview and then on day one, they just say, great, thanks for showing up, good luck. Do you come in? Do you work shadow shifts? Do you have orientation shifts for some period of time? Are you staffed not by yourself for a while? Are you staffed where there's plenty of help around? All those things, do they send you to a course? Do they go over specific curriculum with you? Those are all things that can be factored into an onboarding process for bringing someone on.
You're in the middle of almost the interview stage of things. So let's say you found a position, got a good CV, and we can talk more about CVs maybe, but you know, basically you got yourself, you found the position you like, you found out what's important for you, but now you're trying to actually confirm. Basically, for me, the interview is a lot of, I want to confirm what I've actually heard. I want to see what the site looks like. I want to see how people interact with one another. And I want to see if I can get some very important questions that are going to be individualized to that site. Now, for anyone who's worked in anything almost in medicine, the first job you pick, it's going to be really hard to know what you actually want. And a lot of times people will leave their first position, sometimes frustrated because they didn't find a position that they felt like they were able to negotiate well for, and they found what they want and they got to do what they want, and all that sort of stuff plays a role. But you get better at that with time. With each position you apply for, you find a little bit more out. But let's say you've in that position, you are now sitting at the interview table or you're on your site visit. What are some of the things that you want to make sure you accomplish besides talking about the onboarding process?
Yeah, and I think you hit on a lot of that already. And I just wanted to add, and we'll talk some more too, is that while you're there, you definitely want to talk to some of the staff folks.
Absolutely.
The staff PAs, the physicians, to kind of get their feel. You know, hey, are you guys happy here? How long have you been here? What's the turnover like, you know, for the PAs? Do you feel supported by your physicians? To the physicians, do you support your PAs? How long have you worked with them? How's the relationship? How do you guys use each other? Is it collegial? All those things factor in. And I think it's just so key that you do your research and take your time with this, because, you know, getting that job is kind of like marriage. You know, you don't want to get into it too quickly and then regret it, you know, in a few months. I'm sure you did. I know I did have classmates, their first job out, their first year out, they changed jobs, you know, once, twice, three times in a year. And obviously that doesn't look good on a CV. I could tell you that when you look at a CV and go, let's see. So in a year and a half, you've had four jobs. That's kind of strange. It's kind of a red flag right there. So I tell folks, take your time, do your research. And things to ask, I tell people, when you come into an interview, do your research. Do your research on the group you're interviewing with. Do your research in the location. Do your research with the hospital. Again, get on the internet and just Google them. Because I can't tell you the times that I've interviewed folks and said, great, so tell me about, what do you know about our group? And literally, I've had folks say, not much. And I say, okay. Well, what do you know about the area, the hospital? I don't know. And I thought, okay, well, you obviously didn't do any homework and look up what you're getting yourself into. So definitely do your research because you want to know what you're getting yourself into. Also, have some questions prepared. I mean, they could just be super basic things about the location, the hospital, the practice, the group, benefits, all those things. But you definitely want to appear engaging and interactive with the person interviewing you. Again, I've had folks who, at the very end of the interview, I say, great, do you have any questions? And they just say, nope. I say, okay, well, I guess that's that then. So I'm sure everyone can think of at least, you know, one or two questions, but just to, again, make that engagement interactive so that they know, hey, you know what, Chip's interested, he's asking questions, he's energetic, he's dynamic, all those things. And then show up on time. I'm a big on-time person. And if you show up late, that's already a strike against you. So please just be on time. And then it isn't a bad idea to maybe bring your CV along, bring an extra copy in case the person interviewing you didn't have a copy with them and stuff, and know your CV inside and out so that when they ask you, you can automatically have responses. And also, if there's gaps in your CV, be prepared to explain them. If for some reason, if your employment history shows that you had a little 2-year sabbatical, most people reviewing CVs will catch that. Most of the time, I would think they're going to ask you about it. So it's good to have an answer down of, for whatever reason, I caring for an ill family member, I went and did the Peace Corps, I, who knows, but just be prepared to explain that. So
I was just going to add to that, when you're looking at the CV and you're going through, especially before you even hand this to anyone, have multiple people look over this. I'm actually looking over some students right now, their CVs, and we're going over them. And some of the things are just as simple as, we need to fix grammar, we need to fix punctuation, spelling, whatever. Those are real basic. And really, if you have someone who is really solid on English and proper grammar and stuff like that, get them to look at it. But have your colleagues, or have, if you're a student, have some sort of preceptors or whatever. Get the right people in that field to look over things. One that I will tell you is a pet peeve of mine, and probably most people don't care. Fred, I don't know if you care or not, but this is not the ER. It's the emergency department, or we're practicing in emergency medicine. I'm not an ER PA. I'm an emergency medicine PA. I don't practice in the emergency room. And, you know, I may practice in emergency department, but that's my PA is not being in the ER. It has more to do than that. So little things like that can get under the nerves of certain people. And like, if you pick more neutral wording or more proper wording for a certain role, it'll just make you sound that much smarter and that much above the grade.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I mean, there's nothing that's a bigger turnoff when you get a CV that's just full of spelling errors or grammatical errors. Very big turnoff. And the one thing that I wanted to, the last thing I wanted to add, it's 2017. Be very aware of social media. Most people, I would say that when they're interviewing folks for positions, they're probably going to check you out on the internet. So if you're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, whatever, just be very aware of what's on there, what's being posted, what pictures are on there, because most responsible employers will probably check that. And if there's something that you don't want your mom to see, it's probably something you don't want your employer to see or future employer to see. So just be very aware of that. Now, I think LinkedIn is also a great professional resource. It's kind of like professional Facebook, and it's a great way to connect with other folks in similar areas, similar likes, similar fields. But just be very aware of Facebook and Twitter and all those social media channels, because they can come back to haunt you.
I didn't have that much of an interesting, you know, college or post-grad time, but I know some people, it definitely was an issue for them when they were trying to find stuff. And especially if you leave your profile set to public, that is not a good option. Just in general, that's asking for stalkers and stuff like that. So just be good to yourself and don't leave your profile set to public or crap like that. Like, have very little exposure as possible. I know some people, and I don't know, this only throws a red flag to me when I see this. I don't know how you feel about it, Fred, but when I'm looking at an interview of an applicant and maybe I find them because they're connected to another friend or something like that, I somehow still find them. But let's say they may have put their name in backwards on Facebook, or they may have put the letters slightly separated, or did something funny to try and change their name. Like, I understand the thought process. The thought process behind that is it makes it harder for an employer to find me. But then when I do find you on social media and I know you're there, it just throws a little bit of a red flag at me. Like, are you trying to purposely hide something? If so, you didn't do a very good job at it. And if it's just you don't want anyone to see it, then switch it to a more private setting. That's just my thought.
No, I completely agree. And something I just thought of too is, be aware of your email address. You know, if you create your email address back when you were in college and you're applying for a job now that you're 36, just for example, and your email address is sexyguy259@yahoo.com, it probably isn't really appropriate. And I think it definitely kind of raises some eyebrows when people see that. So if you can, try to go with some sort of neutral, you know, email address that isn't quite too controversial or eyebrow raising.
And some things just as simple as like putting in your name, like your name if you can find it, or things like that. Things that are going to be public. One thing not to do, at least for me, I think, especially if you're a young person or someone who's older, like if you're middle range, may not be as big of a deal. But a lot of people, when they say, oh, there's multiple of my name, they'll then put in their birth year right behind it or something.
Oh,
that's just, you're just giving away your age, and technically that's a protected piece of information when you're interviewing because of age and stuff like that. Just something to maybe think about, maybe figure out a different thing to use to make you unique. Just,
yeah, absolutely. And just in terms of just security, I mean, just getting out that personal data. I mean, unfortunately, we live in a world of, you know, fraud and data breaches and all that stuff. Obviously, you don't want to jeopardize your personal information by giving out some sort of a little hint at it.
All great points, Fred. So let's recap here. So we talked about the actual beginnings process of finding a position. We talked a little bit about your CV and how to narrow down said positions. We talked about your presence on social media. We talked about the interview. All great points, but we haven't got to the contract side and how to deal with salaries and negotiations and stuff like that. So Fred, I think we're going to have to make this a separate podcast. We may just have to, you know, make this last a little bit longer. Fred, if you don't mind, I think we're going to have you give the tagline for this round.
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.